Tonight on Extension 720, we talk about a vast and burgeoning area of science and of payoff, that is practically applied science, broadly labeled biotechnology. Three biotechnologists or biotechnicians are my guests tonight. They are distinguished men of science. In fact, John Leonard is vice president of research and development at Abbott Laboratories. Charles Buck is the director of operations at the Bindley Bioscience Center at Purdue University. And Milan Mrkšić is professor of chemistry and the head of a lab with his own name, Mrkšić Lab, at the University of Chicago. They all specialize in different areas of biotechnology. But gentlemen, I want to read you briefly the classic description of the first biotechnologist. Chapter 25 is where we begin, of the book of Genesis. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our own image, after our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And the Bible goes on to explain some aspects of the biotechnological technique that God employed. We know at least that in the making of the female, he extracted a rib from the male he had made, and out of that rib, he generated the female. Does that sound like modern biotechnology in any sense? Or has that sort of been in the mind and the model of scientists as they've moved over hundreds or thousands of years towards the attempt to achieve dominion over life in and through the laboratory?
Certainly.
Milan Mrkšić.
Yeah, in the natural world, Milt, we've known for a long time that in the farming industry, for example, corn strains could be mixed to develop corn strains that had desired properties. And folks were doing that hundreds of years ago before we understood what genetic processes underlie that kind of crop development. So in some sense, the natural world, as you point to, does provide us the inspiration for doing what we do today, which is to, in a more controlled scientific manner, isolate DNA, learn how to manipulate that DNA, and then have organisms take that DNA and make proteins out of that code.
Where would one and how would one place Gregor Mendel in his research, which generated the first notions of the first applicable and workable models of inheritance, of genetic process, even though he didn't know about genes, even though he knew nothing about DNA, but still with his sweet peas, he supposedly got ratios which taught us a great deal about the nature of inheritance and thus maybe the possibility of controlling inheritance. I imagine, for that matter, going into the sort of agricultural or animal husbandry or agrotechnology that Milan was just talking about, that Mendelian genetics would have been relevant in the minds of those who began to do that sort of crossbreeding.
Well, absolutely. And of course, this was going on long before Mendel sat down to study it. And he's really considered, I think, by many to be the prototypic scientist because mm-hmm. of his curiosity and his very careful documentation. I think this search for tools is one of the real hallmarks of biotechnology from the very beginning. And the passage that you quoted could be characterized as a search for tools. For example, we may not grab a rib and try to beat it into a woman, but we certainly are constantly looking for new tools.
But the ultimate dream, really, along biotechnological lines, it seems to me, is to create life itself out of non-living material. The Frankenstein achievement. No, Frankenstein isn't quite right either, because he's using portions of once functional bodies to put the monster together. But perhaps at the University of Chicago a long time ago, but predecessors of yours, Milan, namely Uri, and Miller, and their research, which came close, some people think, to creating life.
Yeah, that was classic work that really investigated how the basic molecules of life could be created. before anything living was on the planet. So how amino acids could be created if you had the right mix of thunder and humidity and mineral surfaces. What we're talking about in biotechnology is not so much creating life. That's still a far, far distant, if ever possible, challenge for scientists. But what we're talking about is using the machinery of life to create pieces of life that can augment a living system. So in very simple terms, if a patient has a disease that's caused by a deficiency of a protein, we now understand the rules by which we can treat that patient with DNA so that their body, their life, can take the DNA and make protein and restore the condition.
My problem in getting this program ready is that I know virtually nothing about biotechnology, but of course I've gone to the encyclopedic sources. I do want to read to you the general overview definition of biotechnology that one gets from the Encyclopedia Britannica. And then I will ask, to begin with, John Leonard to tell me whether this is an adequate overview and basic definition or whether it's wrong or simply incomplete. This is two longish paragraphs, but they're basic. The growth of the field of biotechnology, says EB, is closely linked to the development in the 1970s of genetic engineering, paren, the directed alteration of genetic material. Substances that have been produced in this manner include human interferon, a natural virus-fighting substance, human insulin, and human growth hormone. The techniques of genetic engineering, splicing, transplantation, and chemical replantation of repressed non-functional genes also offer the possibility that a number of hereditary disorders may be, quote, corrected by manipulation. Recombinant DNA techniques in conjunction with the development of a technique for producing monoclonal antibodies, paren, antibodies produced by single clones of antibody-producing cells, close paren, have made an evident impact on medical diagnosis and oncology, oncology being the study of cancer. Another important use of genetic engineering is the production of bacteria used to biodegrade oil spills and toxic wastes. Biotechnology had its origins in a 1980 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that, quote, a live human-made microorganism is patentable matter. This ruling resulted in the establishment of a number of commercial firms, among them Genentech, Biogen, New England Biolabs, Cetus, and Genex, firms that manufacture quantities of gene-engineered substances for a variety of mostly medical and ecological uses. Is that adequate as an overview of the field?
Well, those are all certainly instances of biotechnology. I think that the field is bigger than that, and that is a...
What's left out?
Well, I think Milan referred to it earlier. Biotechnology, I think, can be very simply stated as harnessing biological processes to do things, make products, solve problems. In the definition you read, there wasn't a lot of agricultural use, for mm-hmm. example. I think that any... a person who is basic in the agricultural world would be somewhat offended by that being left out, because...
You know, in another thing from another encyclopedia, I find that there are four or five separate fields of biotechnology, and they're color-coded. There's red biotechnology, white biotechnology, green biotechnology, which is what you're just referring to, I think, and bioinformatics, sometimes called... What color have they given that? Blue biotechnology.
I don't know why that one's blue, but the green one makes sense to me, which is certainly tied to agriculture. But I would include things like even alternative sources of energy, which relies mm-hmm. increasingly on biotechnology. For me, it's manipulating different forms of life or life-type processes, and it's not to have dominion over it or to make life necessarily, but it's to harness some of the processes that life mm-hmm. gives us. And so whether it's replacing enzymes as was included in the definition that you read for some disease states, that's certainly a mm-hmm. form of it, or if it's manipulating a plant so that it will contain in its substance and its material the starting materials of things that could be made into plastics, for example, that would also be a form of biotechnology.
Would you agree that modern biotechnology does begin with the development of genetic engineering techniques?
I would, yeah. I think that's commonly believed by...
And where do we date that? How far back do we date that?
This is the late 70s. Yeah, mid to late 70s.
So the late 70s to now, We're talking about essentially a 30-year period, or a little bit less than 30 years. What are the main biotechnological accomplishments of these last 28 or so years?
Well, I would point to a couple. I think there are now several biopharmaceuticals, real pharmaceuticals that are FDA approved and that are produced and sold, which are protein products and that are made using these recombinant methods. And the other component, the other class of products are agricultural products. There are many, many foods that are now available at the grocer that were ultimately derived from bioengineered plants. And the interesting thing here, Milt, is that the United States and Europe, for example, have very different rules on what kinds of bioengineered plants can be used to generate food products.
We are, they are tighter than we are. Is that the way that goes? Or
that's
is it the
correct.
Other way around?
No, that's the way. In Europe, it's much more difficult.
So there's some bioengineered foods that we are now growing or developing and selling are rejected and not allowed into common commerce in Europe. Is that the case?
That is the case.
What such foods are they?
I think the common ones for us are many of the easily spoilable vegetables. So tomatoes, for example, tomatoes have been engineered to give them longer shelf life so that they can be transported to the store and then survive in your home for a few more days before they spoil.
Has anyone thought to engineer tomatoes so that they taste like tomatoes again?
They look like tomatoes.
Yeah, but they don't really quite taste like tomatoes. Why is that? Is that a consequence of the bioengineering, or is it?
I suspect it's that they're picked well in advance of they're actually having been fully ripened and being transported to us some days before. I mean, I think all of us would prefer pulling a tomato directly off the plant and taking it to the plate as opposed to having it sit somewhere for several days. I don't think the engineering has so much altered the taste to make it taste different from a tomato. It certainly keeps them redder, however.
Ultimately, they want to get them square rather than round, because that makes for better...
Easier to stack.
Yeah, easier to stack.
Interesting aesthetics as well, I suppose, yes.
Now, John Leonard, you are, as I think you are aware, the Vice President of Research and Development at one of the great pharmaceutical companies of the world, Abbott Laboratories. How much new control, how much increase in our actual ability to diagnose properly and to treat properly difficult and threatening diseases have we achieved through the genetic engineering or the biotechnological phase in further research and development?
Well, you know, I guess I think about it a couple of ways. There are therapeutic products that are directly the result of biotechnology. Milan gave some examples. For example, we produce a drug called Humira, which is a engineered monoclonal antibody against one of the inflammatory agents that's active in rheumatoid arthritis. People can inject this antibody that's not made in their bodies, it's made in a plant, and that can remove from the body this inflammatory agent, and with that, patients will have very significant improvements in their rheumatoid arthritis. That's one extreme. But it's almost impossible to imagine making any drug that we do in the modern sense without using biotechnology of some form, whether it's to screen drugs that we take off the shelf, potential drugs that we take off the shelf, or developing in vitro assay systems so that we can test how a chemical might behave before we ever take it into a human. Virtually all of the processes that we use in our discovery efforts employed biotechnological techniques of some sort.
What is Kaletra, K-A-L-E-T-R-A? I am informed that you had a great deal to do with developing it, and it is now produced and marketed by Abbott. What does it do?
Well, Kaletra is a class of drug called an HIV protease inhibitor. This is a drug that we discovered and then developed at Abbott, which forms the backbone of these cocktails that are used to treat patients with HIV infection. It's an important drug because it and other members of its class have very much changed the outlook for patients with HIV infection. It's one of these drugs that have really radically changed the morbidity and mortality of the infection.
And your role in developing it was what?
Well, I started the project and, with other colleagues, ultimately finished. It's a several-year process. It began with chemists in our research laboratories who relied on a series of biotechnological techniques to identify it. And then we did a series of early development procedures before we took it into humans, and then over several years demonstrated its antiviral activity and with that the clinical benefit.
Well, what does it do for an HIV/AIDS patient who already has the virus in him or her, I suppose, and is suffering the symptoms and faces early mortality unless? What does this do to increase the strength of the variable titled unless?
Well, the most fundamental problem that patients with HIV infection have is that virus is destroying their immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the higher the levels of virus in their body, and we can readily measure this in their blood, the faster the rate of immune damage. And so when we set out to make therapeutic agents, the primary goal is to drive that viral titer down to the lowest possible limits. And there's a variety of different drugs that do that, all of which, when combined in patients, can reduce virus down to very, very low levels so that the immune system can reconstitute and patients can avoid the morbidity and, in many cases, the mortality that results from those infections.
What do you know, in fact, in terms of reliable research as to just how efficacious drugs of this class are for AIDS patients?
Well, we have a lot of data. In our work, we have patients who have taken this drug, you know, when they take it properly, comply as prescribed, that now in excess of 8 years, it is possible that you can actually drive viral titers down to undetectable levels, which means that it's very, very hard with commonly used diagnostic tools that we have to find the presence of the virus. We believe, and I think many in the field do, that if you treat people appropriately and at the right time, early enough, it may be possible for people to live their natural lifespan.
I noted that in the big biotechnology meeting, which occurred in town here just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, that one of your key speakers was, of all people, Magic Johnson, who was diagnosed a while ago as an AIDS sufferer. And I gather he's a living example of the efficacy of this drug package, is he?
He takes Caletra. He's taken it for several years, and he shared with me and us that, in fact, he has had undetectable levels of virus now for several years.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an individual, aside from the good he's doing by calling attention to the disease and its proper treatment, who, although it's unfortunate he's infected, he was infected at a good time, which is when these drugs were just first becoming available. Mm-hmm. So he's benefited from the protease era and has had an excellent clinical course.
I hope to hear from our other two panelists some similar stories about the pursuit of ways of treating, more effectively diagnosing and then far more effectively treating major killer diseases. And we'll go on with that right after a quick update on the evening's news as we go to the newsroom and to Rob Hart. And we are becoming acquainted tonight with some, though surely not all, of the achievements of modern biotechnology. Our guests are Milan Mrkcic, who is professor of chemistry and head of the Mrkcic Lab at the University of Chicago. He specializes in work, and here I'm just reading what's in front of me, at the interface between the material and biological environment. That needs translation, which I will seek shortly. John Leonard, who is an MD, our other two guests are PhDs. John Leonard is Vice President of Research and Development at Abbott Laboratories. And Charles Buck is the Director of Operations at the Bindley Bioscience Center down at Purdue University. What happens at the Bindley?
At the Bindley, we attempt to cover the waterfront of bioscience research, both within the university and as it relates to the economy and to our citizens in Indiana. So we engage faculty, investigators at the university, develop technologies in particular that we deem to be of commercial value and likely to be successful in the economic sector. And also we reach out to local biotech companies, small and large, pharmaceutical companies, and engage them to carry out research that utilizes our specific infrastructure and expertise at the university.
Now, I note that one area that you've worked in is oncology, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
What particular aspect of that vast realm of medical science have you been directly involved in?
Well, we are focusing a lot of our efforts on a kind of reverse engineering of cancer. So the it's becoming increasingly clear as we learn more about cancers that this is a heterogeneous disease, and that a liver cancer is not a liver cancer is not a liver cancer. And so with the current state of technology, and in particular our ability to handle huge quantities of data, the bioinformatics that you spoke of, we're able to now catalog with much greater granularity the molecular profile of specific diseases, for instance, specific types of cancer, cancer in specific individuals. And that's leading us toward tailoring our approach to specific, to diseased individuals.
What do you mean when you say liver cancer is not a liver cancer is not a liver cancer?
So the disease is, the makeup of the cells is very heterogeneous, and John could perhaps, as an MD, could perhaps speak very better to this than I can, but even for a well-trained pathologist with decades of experience, there are subtle differences in the makeup of cells which we can detect at the molecular level, but which can't be seen at the microscopic level.
But they all have the property of growing when you don't want them to grow.
True, but at vastly different rates, with vastly different cocktails of ingredients that promote and will repress their growth, and sometimes subtly different, sometimes quite different.
So all the cancers that we speak of in normal human parlance, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, brain cancer, really are not single diseases, but are families of diseases. Is that right?
With few exceptions, yeah.
What are the few exceptions?
Well, there's one particular leukemia which results from a chromosomal translocation, and this is now being fairly effectively treated with the new monoclonal antibody, for example. This is the so-called Philadelphia chromosome. This is a relatively homogeneous disease, but even there, we're finding that patients who initially benefit from this monoclonal antibody treatment, a subset of those patients will become resistant to that treatment, indicating again that there's some heterogeneity even in a disease which, from the molecular standpoint, from a molecular biologist's point of view or molecular geneticist, that is a well-defined aberration, a well-defined mutation.
So what you've said makes clear that there, what is very important is not merely treatment, but before you can decide on the proper treatment or even begin to develop a new treatment through research, you've got to have a much more detailed understanding of the nature of the tissue change in one versus another cancer, even though they all may occur in different people at the same organ locus.
Yes, that's very much the case. And we are sort of likening this to taking apart a toy, for example. So if you really want to know how something works as a kid, you typically will start to take it apart and see if you can put it back together. And I think we're now at a stage where we're able to do that with much greater granularity than we've ever
been. What do you mean by granularity? You used that word before.
So with a greater level of detail. So what we used to think was a single unit, for instance, liver cancer is a single disease, we now recognize is multifactorial and heterogeneous. At the molecular level, we can say the same thing. We understand that there are a given number of genes, for example, 30,000 human genes, but we're recognizing that those 30,000 human genes are translated into a protein diversity which is at least an order of magnitude greater than that. And we're now able to selectively pick those out, lay them out on a table and say, okay, how do these 100,000 components look in this diseased individual versus a normal?
John Leonard, MD, Dr. Leonard, what would you want to add, or how would you want to elaborate upon what we've just heard from Charles Buck?
Well, I think basically he's got it right. You know,
he gets an A?
He gets an A+.
All right.
I think what's going on now is that medicine in general, cancer in particular, is being thought about more in molecular terms. The word cancer is a very descriptive one, and you identified some of the characteristics that were noted centuries ago in terms of people with malignancies. I think what we've learned is that as we can achieve the granularity that Charles is referring to, that we can understand a molecular classification of what is what. And with that, when we identify the abnormalities of these cells, we can think very specifically about how to correct that abnormality. So, for example, in many instances, cancers will result from a variety of changes, some of which include switches that tell a cell to grow in an uncontrolled fashion. So if it's possible to literally turn that switch off, one can reverse some of the characteristics of those cancerous cells.
I can't readily walk to the Bindley Bioscience Center at Purdue, or even to Abbott Laboratories at Abbott Park. Is that
That's correct.
The name of the location? But I could walk within 5 or 7 minutes to Milan's laboratory at the University of Chicago, though I've never been in it. We've got some commercials coming. After that, let's open the door and walk in to the Mirksic lab at the University of Chicago and find out what goes on there. We return directly after this. And so, walking down 57th Street to Ellis Avenue, we enter your laboratory. It's a laboratory named for you. That means you, when you came, you brought along a number of colleagues and juniors, I suppose.
Yeah, in the university, a chemistry department has roughly 20 professors, and each of them has a research program. So in addition to teaching courses, we really do administer and run a research program. We each build our program from scratch. Currently, I've got about 25 researchers working with me. And our primary interests are really in developing the technologies that allow us to understand the molecular basis of disease, the technologies that give us a window into biological samples to tell us which activities are normal and which protein activities might be associated with a disease state.
So you're working with tissue samples, basically, are you?
We do. And so we use biotechnology in a couple of respects. In one, as you've heard earlier this evening, it's for many diseases known that a disease is caused by a protein either being overactive or inactive. So many cancers are caused by enzymes known as kinases being unregulated, and they're constantly acting, and the effect of that is to drive cell growth. And that's why cancers are uncontrolled growths of cells and tissue. They've lost their ability to stop growing when the tissue is at its normal natural size. And so the interesting thing with biotechnology, what we can do today that we could not do 30 years ago, is we can go in and we can clone out of a patient's DNA. We can clone the DNA that codes for that aberrant enzyme. And the advantage of that is we can now work with the enzyme alone and not have to study the enzyme in the context of a complex cellular sample, but we can produce that enzyme, we can purify it, and then we can search for small molecules that can interact with that enzyme and turn off its function.
When Charles was saying earlier that liver cancer is not liver cancer, that they all have their own, there are many unique types, and they have to be very closely diagnosed down to what you call the granular level. Would the same be true, for example, of breast cancer in women?
Certainly.
All right. Then show me how this would work. Suppose a lady discovers one day, while a lady of 42 or thereabouts, while she's doing the appropriate examination of her breast, discovers a lump. It scares her. She goes to the doctor. The doctor says, I think we better get a biopsy on this. They do. Are we now, by virtue of the kind of work that you've been talking about, in a better position to get a close understanding of what has gone wrong with her breast tissue and thus what to do about that problem?
We're at the position now that we know a lot more about what makes one patient treatable with a certain drug and another patient not responsive to that.
And that would be true even for breast cancer.
That would be true for some forms of breast cancer as well as many of the other cancers. We still don't understand the whole story, so this is still an area where medicine is making progress, and progress comes slowly but surely.
But then the kind of progress you're talking about, returning back to the theme or to the problem of breast cancer, because that's something lots of people listening to us tonight worry about, and many have had some encounter with it, or rather with or had that problem in their families. There is then greater efficacy in the diagnosis and the treatment of breast cancer by virtue of these developments in biotechnology?
There is. And so one way I would explain it is that we're all familiar with simple kinds of tests that we can do, and a home pregnancy test would be an example. These are used very frequently, and you have a dipstick, you expose it to urine, and you see what color it turns. And so that's an example of a sensor. which is able to interact with the biological fluid and tell you what the condition is, pregnant or not pregnant. The vision here, Milt, is that many, many groups, both researchers and companies, are developing these kinds of tests that would allow us to go and take a patient sample, take their blood, and then determine what type of cancer they might have in the liver, for example. And that would lead to an era of personalized medicine where a patient would come in, would be diagnosed with liver of the pancreas, and then by performing these tests, we would be able to subtype that cancer and know which drugs to use. And that's something that just in the past few years, I would say, is becoming an achievable goal. And it's going to be some years still until that becomes a routine practice in medicine, but one thing that's for sure, in another generation, a number of diseases will be treated through personalized diagnoses where each patient gets a customized treatment that's going to work best for their type of disease.
Can't come soon enough.
None of these things ever do come soon enough.
So far we've been talking, I think, all the applications we've been talking about are in the category of RED biotechnology. I'll read a definition. RED biotechnology is biotechnology applied to medical processes. Some examples are the designing of organisms to produce antibiotics and the engineering of genetic cures to cure diseases through genomic manipulation. Now, another category is white biotechnology, defined as biotechnology applied to industrial processes. An example is the designing of an organism to produce a useful chemical. White biotechnology tends to consume less in resources than traditional processes when used to produce industrial goods. So let's take biotechnology into the industrial setting, ultimately into the factory. What do we know about what's been happening in that realm?
Well, I mean, one great example is stonewashed genes. So stonewashed genes are the faded genes that you see everywhere. And the way that they become stonewashed is that an enzyme which has been cloned and produced in mass quantities is added to the processing of the clothing before it's sold.
You know, I had a momentary confusion. I really thought you were speaking of stonewashed genes, G-E-N-S.
J-E-N-S. Sorry. Yeah. I didn't catch the pun. And in your detergent that you use in your own home dish clothes washer will often contain mass-produced cloned enzyme molecules to give you that sparkling clean or the whiter whites.
What other industrial applications are we already familiar with?
Rubber, the material the car tires are made out of.
Yeah.
It turns out that certain rubbers for very high performance applications, you cannot use synthetic rubber because it's not as strong. But rubber that comes from the rubber tree and which can be genetically engineered to increase the amount of rubber that can be isolated from those trees and plants is widely used in a number of high performance basically rubber applications, including aircraft tires and other military applications.
Does Abbott work in that realm at all, or it's not the medical realm, but rather the realm of industrial production?
Well, we use fermentation at a large scale, not to make beverages, which is what many people associate fermentation with, but to make starting materials for certain biopharmaceuticals, in particular class of antibiotics called the macrolides. These are things like erythromycin or clarithromycin. Natural products and fermentation procedures are used to make some of the very first chemicals, which are then modified into the final state that is given to patients.
I think I read someplace a few years ago, and occasionally I hear mutterings about this, even quite recently, that the ultimate technology that will be coming with regard to information processing, with regard to computers, so to speak, and other such gadgets, may very well involve biological rather than merely substance or chemical or electrodynamic processes. You're nodding in the affirmative, Milan. What do you know that I don't know about that?
Well, this is an area that in the past 2 or 3 years has seen just tremendous progress. What we're starting to understand is that the ways that human beings develop from a single cell, a single fertilized egg cell, are remarkable computational processes. And they're computational because the DNA, 3 billion letters long, is really the instruction set, the blueprint for life. And that DNA encodes some 50,000 proteins. And what we're now beginning to understand is that there's incredible mathematical sophistication to how different proteins are turned on and off during the course of development, the course of embryogenesis. And what's exciting, Milt, is in the past year or so, there are a number of folks, engineering and semiconductor, and the folks who build computer chips, which are looking to those biological architectures, those biological strategies for building complexity.
Well, they're looking to them to provide models or to use somehow, quote, living matter in the machines.
More the former, so more trying to understand the rules by which these components assemble. And so that's the one side, which I think is coming along, and over the next several years is going to see some real impact in chip design. The other area, which is, can we use living biological tissue as a computer? Can you plug your computer into your brain, if you like, and create an interface? Now, this is an area that clearly has a history in science fiction, but one that also has some very real products. Today, there exist cell-based devices, computer chips that have cells, living mammalian cells, which are integrated into those chips.
What devices are those?
Today, they're largely sensors. It turns out that cells are remarkably good at sensing their environment and responding by turning on different processes.
This fascinates me. What's living cells with what history? How did they get in there?
Normally, these cells are cultured. We work with cells just like you.
But from what animal base?
They can be usually cow or rat, but they can come from many sources. Some are even derived from human sources. And we know how to work with these in the laboratory, how to connect them to electrodes. And essentially what goes on is if the cell is exposed to an agent that it has been genetically programmed to recognize, it will generate an electrical activity that you can monitor.
How do you keep the cell alive in a machine?
Well, we basically have tiny incubators. You take something the size of your fingernail, your little fingernail, and that would have a bath in it. It would contain what we call a media, really a water solution with a lot of nutrients and salts and oxygen. And that nutrient pool has to be replaced every several hours to keep the cells alive. But these are all now processes which have been integrated into chips, into credit card-sized devices.
But I can't yet buy one down at the corner computer store, can I?
You can't, but it turns out that where this is starting to happen is in the context of sensors of biowarfare agents in the field. And so it turns out that...
So it's in military technology, actually.
The military is investigating these tools and, in fact, is field testing them.
While we're talking about military applications of biotechnology, you and I were talking privately, to the extent that you think it's okay, let's talk publicly about what you've been doing about anthrax at your lab.
Now, we, as I said, we've had a strong interest in developing the tests that are used to identify molecules that could be drug candidates. And with anthrax, of course, there's a real problem because we know that individuals that are infected can be treated in the first 3 or 4 days of infection with antibiotics, Cipro, for example. But if they go more than 4 or 5 days without treatment, the odds of survival are, in fact, quite poor. And now through biotechnology, we, and here I mean the royal we, the field, has been able to identify the proteins, the so-called toxins, that are responsible for disease progression and oftentimes death. We've been able to clone those proteins, make them in the laboratory so we can work with the toxin but not the organism. That's important because the toxin is not lethal like the organism.
There is federal money backing this kind of research, one assumes.
There certainly is, and what's really remarkable is in a period of only 3 or 4 years now, there are a number of drug candidates, small molecules that can be used to test anthrax. The interesting part of this is that it's very difficult to know how to approve those molecules with the FDA because it's impossible to run a clinical trial.
You can't. Well, why couldn't you run a clinical trial on experimental animals?
Well, you can always do animal studies, and those are parts of the trial, but the activity of a drug in an animal doesn't correlate perfectly with its effect.
You're not going to do this with human subjects, obviously.
That's right. That's right.
Is there similar work about other potential biological agents that might be used in warfare?
There is. In fact, there's a panel of roughly a dozen warfare agents which have been identified as plausible threats, and similar work is
ongoing. What are some of those others?
Oh, there are strains of smallpox, for example, is another common. And then there are a number of Ebola-type viruses which have also been put on that list.
We're just scratching the surface, I imagine, of the broad range of work that is being done in biotechnology. But at the moment, we pause for a round of commercials, and then shortly after that, a newscast, and then we return to Drs. John Leonard, Charles Buck, and Milan Mirksic. First, these words. We are tonight trying to get some sense of the vast new field that emerged only over the last 30 years, the field of biotechnology. Three leading participants in that exciting area of science are with us tonight. They are Charles Buck, who is Director of Operations at the Bindley Bioscience Center at Purdue University, former Chief Scientific Officer at Auritas, is that the way you pronounce
Auritas,
it?
Yes.
Auritas Biomed in Graz, Austria, and former co-director of the Molecular Core Lab at Emory University, where you worked on Alzheimer's disease, one of the things we have not yet talked about. Our other guest, John Leonard, Vice President of Research and Development at Abbott Laboratories, who is noted for his research on HIV and AIDS, of which we have spoken some tonight. And Milan Mirksic is professor of chemistry and head of his own laboratory at the University of Chicago, where he specializes in work at the interface between the material and biological environment. There's that phrase again. What does it mean? The interface between the material and biological environment.
Now, we frequently in medicine have cases where you put tissue or tissue samples in contact with a man-made material.
Mm-hmm.
In implanted devices, materials are inserted into the body for repairing function, and we worry quite a lot about how to tailor the surface of that mm-hmm. material so that it interfaces with the surrounding tissue in ways that are more normal and don't lead to rejection.
Well, how interesting. We were talking just a bit before we came on the air about my artificial knee and some trouble that developed with it, so I was off the air for a week or so because a piece of it came off and ultimately poked through the skin. Now, that's artificial material. It's titanium, isn't it?
Yes.
In contact with human tissue, and something went a little bit wrong. So that's that's illustrative of the category you're talking about.
Absolutely. So oftentimes a material goes in, and if the material isn't properly finished, it can lead mm-hmm. to an immune response. The immune system recognizes the material as a foreign body and actively promotes to expel the material.
Yeah.
And so our group is interested in learning how to decorate that material with proteins, for example, biotechnology products, so the material looks like normal surrounding tissue and is accepted by the surrounding tissue and not rejected.
What are some of the major implants that we put into the human body these days?
I can give you a good example.
Yeah.
Stents are put into coronary arteries.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that coronary artery disease is a very common problem in the United States. And atheromas will form and clots will form around that. And we will occlude the blood flow to downstream parts of the heart and have a myocardial infarction or heart attack. A way of addressing that is to introduce a piece of metal called a stent, which is advanced into these arteries and then expanded on top of a balloon to expand and keep open that artery. Now,
it's like shoring up a sagging section of a mine.
Pretty much so. I mean, I think that's a good description. Where the technology is now is beyond just shoring it up, we're actually applying chemicals to the surface mm-hmm. of these drugs, of these stents, so that over time they will elute chemicals that will prevent the scar tissue from forming, that will still, in some cases, form around that stent and lead to occlusion in a minority of those patients. So we've gotten to the point where the stent plus a coating on the surface that contains a drug that slowly leaches out can avoid occlusions in the vast majority of cases and pretty much eliminate these post-procedure.
What is that drug that slowly leaches out?
Well, there's different ones. A common one is Taxol, which is used to treat some malignancies.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a class of drugs that are used that are immune suppressants that slow the growth of cells, and these are applied in products that are available and that are under research as well, including at Abbott.
We were talking earlier as I was reviewing some of the background of you three guests and of your earlier jobs. We were with regard to Charles Beck, we made some mention of the fact that at Emory you worked on Alzheimer's disease. I suppose you still do.
Yeah, we're actually doing a little bit of work now in Alzheimer's with respect to characterizing the abnormal deposits that occur in neurons that many believe contribute to the pathology and to the dementia. So these are originally thought to be, again, fairly homogeneous material, so-called amyloid deposits. We now are picking those amyloid deposits apart and realize that they're a very complex mixture of different
A crude proteins. Version of that hypothesis was that somehow aluminum got into the nervous system and produced the Alzheimer's.
Still a working hypothesis for many groups, somewhat controversial, but there are a number of heavy metals that have been implicated in Alzheimer's etiology.
But at the same time, Alzheimer's does have a visible genetic component, has it not?
In a small minority of patients,
to a small degree.
The vast majority of cases, and John can certainly speak to this from his medical training, in more detail than I, but most cases are sporadic, not thought to be genetically caused.
Caused then by contact with some kinds of injurious materials?
Possibly.
Well, I think there's some research coming out, and we're very active participants in this, which explore the plaque hypothesis to a different extent. We've learned, as have others, that there's soluble forms of components of that amyloid, which are directly toxic to neurons, you know, the cell type that's present in the brain.
What is an amyloid?
This is a name for a homogeneous form of protein that will precipitate, in large globules in the brain that is
plaque
toxic.
Formation of
plaque. This would be another simple name for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what we're learning is that some of these components are directly toxic to the brain in their soluble form in solution. And some of the work that we and others are doing are looking at ways to actually remove that soluble substance by supplying antibodies that are directly active against it and slowly having that substance leach out of the brain. It's very exciting research.
Is that in operation on a test basis with humans yet?
Very early stages in the preclinical form, not yet in human testing, at least the way I'm describing it. There are people in other organizations who have tried to make vaccines against some of this material, and it's probably not the optimal way of going about dealing with the disease, but some progress has been made.
Why is Alzheimer's so closely correlated with age? You don't really get a young Alzheimer's patient very often at all, do you?
Very rarely. I'm not sure we know exactly all of the processes that lead to it. These pathological hallmarks that we're referring to, plaques and tangles and things like that, do occur with increasing incidence the older a person is. They don't always correlate, however, with presence of disease. So you can find a person with Alzheimer's, very significant Alzheimer's, and small numbers of plaques. Likewise, you can find people with plaques who have limited clinical evidence of Alzheimer's disease. So it's not a perfect one-to-one correlation.
With regard to Alzheimer's, and even more with regard to Parkinson's disease, there has been conjecture, and maybe even some promises in recent years, that ultimately some sort of cell transfer, some cell replantation, might be possible to reverse the course of the disease. That would be biotechnology, surely, if it were achieved. Is it achievable?
Well, it's been done in terms of transplantation of specific types of cells into human beings, and there have been some controversial reports that have demonstrated efficacy.
It has been done on the human cortex.
It has been done in humans. I don't believe it's ever been done in the States, but it's been done in.
Oh, really?
I think in Mexico, actually. On a very, very limited basis.
Yeah.
Do we have with any serious research follow through, or?
There's been a lot of research. For the most part, in animal models, there are not great animal models for these kinds of diseases, but that line of research has not proven particularly fruitful in animal models, which I think is the main reason it hasn't been further developed here in this country, and, and actually that's true in other places now as well.
We are coming up on another round of commercials, but it is also time to invite telephone calls. If you've got a question you want to raise about yet some other area of biotechnology that we have not yet adverted to, or if you want some further information on something we have discussed, by all means, give us a call instantly. The number, as ever, is 591-7200. 591-7200 for any questions to John Leonard, Charles Buck, and Milan Mirksic. And if you are listening to us over the internet at some greater distance and would rather reach us via email, the email address is, of course, extension 720, as one word, extension 720, at Tribune, T-R-I-B-U-N-E, .com. 591-7200. Don't be hesitant if you've got a question to raise but are not quite sure what the vocabulary is. That's acceptable. I'm not quite sure of the vocabulary either, but we'll work it out when you give us a call at 591-7200. And now we reach the phase in the evening's entertainment when we go to the phones. 591-7200. And as I said, don't be too hesitant if you don't know quite how to formulate the question about whether something you're interested in has been touched by or has aroused the interest of biotechnology researchers. Tell us about it as best you can, and we'll decipher where we have to. 591-7200, the number. And here is the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to know if your guest would talk a little bit about some of the implications of nanotechnology, what some of the implications are in the medical area, maybe give a little background on it. I don't know a lot about it. And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, don't hang up. Stay in there because you may want a follow-up question.
All right.
Actually, Milan, you've been working on nanotechnology with colleagues, not so much at the University of Chicago, but up at Northwestern.
Yeah, it's an excellent question because nanotechnology is in many respects a quite new field, and what it really refers to is the ability to make structures, to make materials that have dimensions at the nanometer scale. So to put that in perspective, it would take about 50,000 nanometers to add up to the width of a human hair, and so that's a very, very small scale. In terms of the biotechnology and the kinds of things we're talking about, where nanotechnology is having the biggest impact is it's giving us some very new approaches to measure proteins in real kinds of clinical samples. So when we talked earlier about trying to figure out what is it that makes a healthy cell different from a disease cell, we have to have ways of going into that cell and looking at the components and sizing them up and making comparisons. And nanoparticles, which are colored in interesting ways, and whose colors can change when those particles interact with specific protein targets, are becoming a very important way for doing those diagnostic tests.
Are they in any way, is there any way that they are constructive or remediative of any medical processes at this point?
Yes, this work is still in the research phase, but there are a number of gene delivery technologies. So here the idea would be that if a certain disease is caused by a mutation in a protein so that that protein is not active, it's effectively not present, one way to restore that protein in the body is to instead deliver DNA which codes for the protein, and then the cells in the body will recognize that DNA and make protein from it. How you get DNA into the cell is a very tough problem. And nanoparticles, because of their sizes, can penetrate into cells more rapidly, and so there's a lot of work going on to learn how to coat nanoparticles with DNA and then allow those particles to carry the DNA into the cells where the cell can then make protein and repair the disease.
I would imagine, John Leonard, that Abbott Labs are also into the nanobiz, so to speak, are they?
We are. Drug delivery is a technology that is very much facilitated by nanotechnology. We don't do so much gene delivery, although some of that might be done in a research phase. But delivering molecules that we can implant in the body and have released over an extended period of time, days or weeks, is something that nanotechnology can permit us to do.
Do you still have the same problems with rejection that you talked about earlier, given the tiny size of these, or is that not an issue?
That tends not to be an issue. One of the things we try to do is make sure that these compounds are not immunogenic, which would mean that the body mounts reaction to them and there's inflammation that takes place at the site. And that tends to be something that we're pretty successful at.
Okay.
We thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Valuable first question, and let's go to the next caller on 591-7200. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a student in engineering at the University of Illinois in Champaign, mm-hmm. and I took an introductory class in bioengineering last year, and they talked a little bit about a program or some research that was being done where they, I believe, put some kind of a computer chip in the brains of people who had been paralyzed or paraplegics, and they actually had found some success rate where they could move a cursor on a computer screen. And I'm wondering if the guests know anything about that.
I would bet one or all of them do. Does or do.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that work. This is, again, a very good question because this addresses some really recent work. But there are these prosthetic devices. If you imagine having a quarter with 50 needles sticking out of it, that would be an electrode array. And these are literally pressed into the brain tissue. And each of those electrodes makes contacts with neural cells around it. And our brains are very interesting because you can have brain damage and slowly regain functions that were lost. And that's because the brain has this plastic ability to reconfigure itself. And
it grows new synapses.
It grows new synapses, and it reconfigures the connections between neurons. So healthy neurons can take over the jobs of neurons that have been damaged. Not always, but in many cases. And the bottom line with the caller's question is there are some very interesting demonstrations in animals and even in people of these pin arrays being transplanted into the brain right at the surface and allowing electrical signals to pass back and forth and to control movement, even to restore a little bit of vision.
Have you ever encountered the research, quite old, of Carl Lashley on equipotentiality? He was a neurosurgeon type, probably 80 to 100 years ago, who did research on brain-injured people, and he noted simply that with a good deal of, say, one portion of the frontal lobe cut out, that over time there is a reemergence of the functions that were temporarily lost, and he hypothesized what he called equipotentiality in terms of neuronal connections, at least in the cortical tissue of the human brain.
There's a technology that's been developed at Purdue University, actually, which has just been commercialized in a small company called Ondara, which is to use this approach to treat spinal cord injured patients. Mm-hmm. And here a device is actually implanted on the spinal cord tissue, which emits a low voltage electrical signal to stimulate the injured neurons. There's been some very dramatic recovery that's been demonstrated already in animal models for spinal cord injury, and that's being taken forward now. That company was just acquired by a larger biomedical device company.
Is that the great step forward that Christopher Reeve was predicting and hoping for?
Well, this is effective very early following injury. It's not clear that it will be effective for a chronically injured spinal cord patient, but this will soon, I predict, soon be a first-line intervention for a chronic spinal cord injury.
Our thanks to the caller for an interesting question, and I think we go quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I've heard that the third greatest cancer killer is currently now colon cancer, and that further, when contracted, it has a 50% death rate. Given those factors, I wondered if there were any, have been any, tailored medicines that are designed to be directed to cure such a disease.
Yeah, we can go back to some of the things we said earlier. It's true for colon cancer, as the examples that were given with respect to lung cancer, where there are, in some cases, very specific molecular markers that are present on the surface of these cells. And there are some monoclonal antibodies that have been made that interact directly with those switches that tell the tumor cells to grow in an unbridled fashion. So some of these therapies are now available and can be gotten in standard medical clinics.
Mm-hmm.
Another good thing to do, and this is diagnostic, is the dreadful procedure known as colonoscopy, which really ought to be undertaken every 2 years by, I suppose, anybody over 40, isn't that right?
Well, I think the American Cancer Society has guidelines that unless there's a family history of it, that a screening on a routine basis should take place at age 50, and then I think mm-hmm. certainly within every 5 years thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Our thanks to the caller, and we are shortly going to the newsroom for a quick update, but it is time to repeat the invitation. If you've been, in fact, trying to reach us and hitting the busy signal, because for a while all the lines were filled, we've now got one or two of them cleared again. So the number remains 591-7200. And we're looking for some good calls from Australia or from somebody who's up quite early in Paris or a little bit later in the morning in Moscow. If you want to reach us from far away, if you're listening on the internet, the email address is extension720, as one word, at Tribune, T-R-I-B-U-N-E, .com. Our guest tonight, as we are taking or attempting an overview of the broad field of biotechnology, are Milan Mirkcic, professor of chemistry and head of his own laboratory at the University of Chicago, Charles Buck, director of operations at the Bindley Bioscience Center at Purdue University, and John Leonard, Vice President of Research and Development at Abbott Laboratories. 591-7200 is where you reach us, and you have just done so. Good evening. Hello, are you there?
Good evening.
Yes, ma'am.
How are you, gentlemen? I'm 55 years old. 8 years ago, I suffered a major hemorrhagic stroke. I was left with significant right side paralysis, some cognitive problems, and some mild communication difficulties. My question is really twofold. First of all, rehabilitation, the studies that you guys have been talking about having to do with spinal cord injuries, will they also help the stroke survivors? And the second part of my question is, I understand having suffered a stroke that currently puts me at an increased risk of Alzheimer's. Is that true? And is there anything I can do to counteract that?
Gentlemen?
Well, maybe I can take a shot at some of that. I think stroke is clearly a very significant medical problem, and most of the work that's been done is in the area of trying to prevent it in the first place. This is controlling risk factors like hypertension, in particular people who have underlying vascular abnormalities. For people who are having an acute stroke, which unfortunately doesn't apply to your caller here, what we try to do is minimize the damage when it actually is taking place. For those who have suffered the damage, there are very few techniques that have proven to be very significant in ultimately reversing the damage once it's taken place. Some of the research techniques that we've heard about, I think, are unfortunately somewhat down the road yet, and probably are not going to be in a position to help the caller here tonight. In terms of increased risk of Alzheimer's disease, I think there is something to that. People who have underlying brain damage will have increased risk of other processes taking place in the brain, but I think it's far from a foregone conclusion that that will be true for you. So in terms of living your life, I think what you want to do is deal directly with your neurologist and whatever rehabilitation procedures he or she has made available for you, and try and be as active and engaged as you can possibly be.
Thank you.
We thank you, ma'am, for the call. Here is an email from somebody in Overland Park, Kansas, who says, I'd like to do a little research on the role that mathematics is playing in the development of biotechnological models and algorithmic solutions, but I don't know on which topics to search. Can your guests perhaps list which areas of mathematics are most critical to biotech researchers today? Certainly it would be well beyond ordinary college calculus and statistics. Charles Buck, take a whack at that one.
Well, I would start with a bit of a arguing with that a little bit. So one of the most important tools that we use very frequently are basic statistical methods and then more advanced statistical methods. So I mentioned earlier the great volume of data that's being generated in a lot of these sorts of approaches that we've talked about, and to be able to visualize that data and to cluster groups of data together is becoming increasingly important. So we frequently use hierarchical clustering methods, for example, that have been available and are taught in freshman courses in colleges for 30, 40, 100 years. More sophisticated methods are also out there and in use, but we use a lot of tried and true methodology. With respect to modeling biological processes, probably Milan is better equipped to talk about some of the approaches there.
Yeah, I'd recommend the caller search on the keywords gene regulatory networks. We're beginning to understand how gene expression as a system, all genes, go up and down, and which genes go up and down in response to different mm-hmm. kinds of diseases. And there's a mathematics that's being developed partly based on neural networks, but also so-called scale-free networks. So I think the caller has some appreciation for some of these mathematical fields. So that's an area to look at, because there's some very exciting work and accessible mathematics to you. And the other area is bioprocess engineering. Really modeling the processes that are used in fermenters and other systems to make biotechnological products.
And with that, on to another call. Here is the next caller. Good evening.
Yes, you were talking about a nanotechnology earlier. I have a question about a drug that came out about a year ago for breast cancer. It's I think the name is Abraxane by a company called American Pharmaceutical Partners. That uses this nanotechnology delivery system with human albumin to deliver the paclitaxel to the cancer. I'm just wondering if you know anything more about this, and is this an up-and-coming thing, or...
Let's turn to John Leonard.
Well, could you repeat the name? I didn't hear it when you said it.
The drug, I think, is called Abraxane. It's...
Spell it.
Something,
spell it,
Abraxane. The company was American Pharmaceutical Partners. They just changed their name to Abraxis Bioscience.
Yeah. No, I'm not familiar with that particular product.
Apparently nobody here is.
I'm not familiar with the product. I am familiar with some work that uses, the caller referred to, albumin as a delivery vehicle. And this is basic.
That's what this is. And I think it was approved by the FDA about a year ago.
Yeah, albumin is a blood protein, and many drugs, when you take them, they get into the blood and they interact with the albumin, and that can be important.
Sir, just a hunch, are you thinking of investing in that firm, or have you just done
yes.
so?
Yes, I am.
Have you made the investment already?
I have some.
I thought that was what motivated it. We thank you for the call, and we pause for these words. And we go directly back to the phones. Here is the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening, Milton, everybody. I would like to expand the subject just a little bit. We hear always the major diseases as getting a lot of the dollars, talking about cancer and some of the other major ones. But I have a specific reason for saying some of the rare diseases that I've been exposed to. One, somebody in the family contracted pancreas, which is an horrible disease, but it seems to have its origins also into the immune system, genetics, and it, to me it looks like it would have, in other words, wouldn't it be to everybody's best interest to include some of these rare diseases?
What disease was that that you're talking about, sir?
It's called pemphigus.
Pemphigus, yes, skin disease.
Anybody, that to tell you how rare it is, but it's a lot of people actually is infected. It's a sort of a Mediterranean-based disease, but it's like the skin is allergic to something that you produce, and it starts breaking into boils all over.
That's right.
It's a tremendous...
Well, let's get some response from John Leonard, who recognizes the name of the disease, as I do not.
Well... Pemphigus is a disease that affects how skin actually holds together. If you think about the covering of the body, which is obviously carried out by the skin, the cells that form skin are held together by a variety of junctions. In the case of pemphigus, that junction is disrupted, and what you can have is these boils or blisters that form and actually exfoliate or lose large parts of skin. It can be very painful and ultimately disfiguring. And so it tends to be an autoimmune disease, I think, in many cases where the body actually forms a reaction against those junctions, and it's very difficult to control.
Yes, my point is this. By including some of these diseases, not only is going to give hope to some of the people that otherwise would not have any hope, but would that be like solving a puzzle where you have the long words, which are the main disease, and the short words, and all together might help solve the puzzle, because they all come from the human body? What I'm saying is that maybe we should take a look at some of these rare diseases as being holding the key for us to solve maybe some of the other questions we still have on the major one.
Milan Mirsic. Well, the caller raises an important point that many scientists struggle with as well, because, as you know, there are a few diseases which are kind of the popular diseases to work on and to get funding for, and then there are many, many diseases that affect small numbers of people, tens of thousands of people, which in the scheme of things is a small number. The federal agencies, the National Institutes of Health, has many programs that are specifically for these low-occurrence diseases. And the FDA has different approval processes to make it a little bit easier to get products approved that normally you wouldn't be able to spend a lot of money on, given the markets that come out. Having said that, I sympathize with the caller, because a lot of these lower diseases aren't pursued aggressively by the larger companies for economic reasons that are very legitimate reasons. And there are successes that come out, but they come out slower. And that's kind of the state of where this thing is.
Our thanks to the caller. What's the distribution of biotechnical expertise around the world? I would presume that a vast amount of the work is done in this country, but where else is it done, and by whom?
Well, it's true that much of it is here in the United States, although it's rapidly changing. Europe was an early participant as well, but we're seeing a very, very significant investment and rise of the industry in the Far East and India as well. In fact, I think these are the emerging competitors for what has been largely an American enterprise up until very recently.
Has most of the training been done in graduate departments in this country?
By and large, that's the case, supplemented by work in Europe. I think we've done a very good job of bringing people in from other countries, staffing our own universities and our own private laboratories with some of these trainees, and we've all certainly benefited from that. More and more, however, these people return back home and are staffing their own universities and increasingly companies.
Does one come to this kind of work essentially with graduate training in chemistry, or are there a number of routes into biotechnology?
There are a lot of routes. The most common route would be graduate training in cell biology or biochemistry, mm-hmm. one of the so-called life sciences. But biotechnology is a field that integrates the biological, the life sciences, chemistry, and information sciences increasingly. So one area you see the most rapid growth is students that are trained in both computer science and one of the biologies. And these are students who are seeing incredible job opportunities and prospects for incredible advances.
Socrates says, I owe a rooster to Asclepius, says that on his deathbed before drinking the hemlock. I owe a quick stop of a quick set of commercials to WGN. And quickly back to the phones, 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Rosenberg?
Yes, sir.
First of all, my wife and I want to let you know that we enjoy you and your program immensely. My question is, 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with acute myoblastic leukemia. I was fortunate enough to have a match and get a stem cell transplant, and followed by donor lymphocyte infusions. In the last 2 years, I've been in and out of remission 4 times. I'm just wondering, with this disease, what progress research is making. I know it's being researched all over laboratories in the world, but is there any promising research to look forward to?
Let's turn to our resident physician on that, John Lennon.
Well, AML, as I'm sure you know better than most, is a very, very tough disease. And if you can't remove the bad cells by doing a bone marrow transplant, then you're stuck with the tough situation of trying to use chemicals, drugs that control the cells that grew back. And you're in an area that is with a cancer that's very difficult to treat, but there are some emerging kinase inhibitors that are increasingly used on an experimental basis. They were referred to earlier in the show tonight. I would encourage you to, either through your physician or even calling people at the National Cancer Institute, and they, I think on the web you could very quickly find their numbers, to make sure that you have access to whatever experimental protocols are taking place to get the latest therapy that's available.
And, sir, with that, we thank you, and we must move rather quickly, time now being rather short. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I understand that your guests are mainly in the medical field of biotechnology, but I was wondering if they were aware of any of the updates as far as energy goes. Particularly, there's a green algae that can produce hydrogen under certain conditions, Chlamydomonas reinhardi.
That's a good question. There's work going on at Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee, which is developing some of these technologies. But the essential attractive piece of this is that these microorganisms can produce hydrogen and some other basic components that can feed fuel cells and might solve in the hydrogen economy, might solve the very serious problem of how one stores the hydrogen. If you have an organism that can reduce water, it can produce hydrogen on demand, and you can avoid this need of carrying around tanks of hydrogen, which is not an attractive thing to do. So an exciting area, still very early, but this is a good example of how biotechnology can be turned to for...
It's one of the many potential answers to the ultimate problem of oil depletion, is it?
That's right, and that's why in the past few years this is an area that's gotten quite a boost in activity.
Sure. Thank you, sir.
Yep, thank you.
And I must read you this interesting email that has come in. It's titled Tomato Talk. If I remember correctly, most food crops are terribly inefficient. That is, take the number of calories a plant uses to grow in the form of sunlight, and then divide that number by the number of edible calories in the final tomato or ear of corn or whatever. The efficiency rate is usually less than 10%. If you use biotechnology to toughen the skin of a tomato, does the energy, in the form of calories, needed to thicken the tomato skin come from elsewhere in the plant, such as the roots? This would mean that extra water would be needed, as well as compromising the stability of the topsoil. So we're in the area of green biotechnology again. Did you understand that?
I understood the first part of it, and it is true that, in fact, the conversion of sunlight into material and ultimately energy mm-hmm. is not such an efficient process. But
only 10%, he says.
That's about right. Mm-hmm. And but the fact is that the sunlight is free. The plant doesn't pay for the sunlight, so there's not a strong pressure for it to be more efficient.
Well, it's free for the next 10 billion years, but after that...
Okay, so we'll get...
It's not at all unusual for any organism to compensate when something has changed, so genetically modifying any kind of an organism, including a plant, may have adverse effects on mm-hmm. other parts of the plant, and that's part of the research process, is figuring out what those are and aren't.
And back to the phones. Good evening. You are on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Back in the 80s, I was in strategic planning for American Hospital Supply before they were taken over by Baxter Travonol. And I remember very well the challenge of predicting when product would come to market. I'm curious to understand from your guests what's going on in the world today, and in particular with the advent of the computers. The chairman of Intel, you know, was attributed with a very well-proven rule that the capacity of computers but double every 18 months. With the speed of change, my question is, how fast is that accelerating, and how much pressure are you to bring new products to market?
Well, I'm the industrial guy, I guess, so I should probably take a crack at that.
At Abbott Laboratories,
absolutely. Are we under pressure? Well, our goal is to bring products to the marketplace that are going to make a difference for patients, and we take that mission very, very seriously, and we spend in the order of $1.5 billion on our research and development budget in the pharmaceutical group to carry out that mission. We are an economic undertaking, which is, I think, a little bit behind your call, and of course it's important that this enterprise makes sense in the end. But we're staffed by physicians and scientists who try to come up with real solutions for patients, and we think if we do that well, the economics will work out in the end. In terms of predictability, you know, it's unpredictable in the final analysis. No one knows yet how to start with a computer, design a molecule from first principles, and then predict how it will behave in thousands of patients so that we can write a label for the FDA without ever having tested any human being. That would be a wonderful thing to have, but we are very far away from even conceiving that.
Our thanks to the caller, and gentlemen, we've got about 2.5 minutes left at the most. How many of you are there out in the world? By you, I mean people who are professionals who by one route or another have come to be active researchers in biotechnology.
I would put the number at the level of 100,000 or so. If you look at scientists at all levels of training and all disciplines that work in this industry. So it's quite a large, mature industry, and in Europe, in the United States, which probably comprise 80% of that base, I would say.
Yeah, you know, there's another way of keeping score, which is the total economic impact of the industry, and certainly from a life sciences point of view, there's estimates that well over 1 million jobs in one form or another are directly made by the biotechnology industry for the life sciences. It's very, very important for certain parts of the United States economy. Chicago, where we are now, certainly is a player in that, and that's something that we very much want to stimulate locally as well.
Are we a biotechnology capital, in fact, this very city?
I'm not sure we're a capital. I think we're an aspiring one, however. Biotechnology traditionally is thought of as being a coastal sort of enterprise. Boston, the Bay Area, San Diego, to a lesser extent, Washington. The Midwest is very much the agricultural capital of the biotechnology industry. And in the Chicago area, and within a few hours driving distance, there's several major pharmaceutical companies that are biotechnology players one form or another.
And with that, we do indeed come to the end of the available time. Our guests tonight have been John Leonard, Vice President for Research and Development at Abbott Laboratories, Charles Buck, Director of Operations at the Bindley Bioscience Center at Purdue University, Milan Mirksic, Professor of Chemistry and Head of the Mirksic Lab at the University of Chicago. And I am much in your debt, gentlemen. It's been, to me, most informative, and I've had the illusion of comprehension through much of our discussion, for which I thank you as well. You are excellent communicators.